Hello, this is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Luke Ford, and I also have Paul Bingham on as a co-host. Luke, meet Paul Bingham.
Hey, Paul Bingham.
Good evening, Luke.
So we've covered a lot of topics over our past interviews. We've talked about your conversion to Orthodox Judaism. We've talked about your journalism in the porn industry. We've covered pretty much plenty of topics. I think what Paul is interested in getting started in is, I'm not that familiar with the Seventh-day Adventist church, but I know both Luke and Paul, you both share the common background in that church, so I will let Paul get things started on that topic.
Well, I think Luke and I have something in common in that we're both kind of incongruous figures on the alternative rights edge, kind of spectators, kind of participants. And I'd just be interested, I've always been interested to read your occasional critiques or writings or observations on the Adventist Church as you grew up in the Adventist Church. And I remember reading one essay you wrote about your return to your alma mater, I believe it was, and you know, and your assessment of the church and how it had changed in the years since you had last been to an Adventist church. And I found that very interesting. My background in the church comes after yours, precedes yours from the 1990s. So where do you see it, you know, where it's back in the news now with Ben Carson a lot? Do you have a assessment kind of or a new perspective of the church and of Carson in 2015, 2016?
Well, I didn't think about the Seventh-day Adventist church that often. It's just that when my life suddenly intersects with it, then, you know, I remember my past, my upbringing in the Seventh-day Adventist church. So, you know, with my life experience, my perspective on my upbringing changes and my understanding of the church changes. So the latest thing that's made me think about the Seventh-day Adventist church is, of course, Ben Carson's candidacy. And for a few days there, Seventh-day Adventist church was a big news story because Donald Trump would point out that he didn't know about the Seventh-day Adventist church, and it's definitely out of the mainstream. So when I grew up as a Seventh-day Adventist, I was taught and accepted as religious truth that we were kind of the successors to the 12 apostles, to Jesus, to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation, to the Puritans, and we were God's truly chosen people. And the name Seventh-day Adventist breaks up into seventh day, meaning we kept the seventh-day Sabbath, and Adventist meant belief in the soon coming of Jesus Christ. So in the news media, there are two primary themes about Seventh-day Adventists when they make the news, and it's fairly rare that Seventh-day Adventism is in the news, but one theme is that Seventh-day Adventists are very healing people, which they do tend to be. The church is about two-thirds women. It's very much centered on a health message and leading a healthy, healing life. And then the other theme about Seventh-day Adventists is that they're weird and apocalyptic and possibly dangerous, such as David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. They came out of the Seventh-day Adventist church. And I think you can see both of those themes with regard to Ben Carson. On the one hand, he received a lot of positive coverage in the news media because he's black and a successful neurosurgeon. One does not usually connote black with neurosurgeon. So he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, did significantly benefit from affirmative action, getting him into college, but he made quite a success of his life. And so that was consistently lauded by the media till he came out as a conservative and challenged President Obama, and is now running for the Republican nomination. And now the other theme, the Seventh-day Adventists, you know, a bit scary, a bit weird, a bit out of the mainstream, and possibly even apocalyptic and dangerous, that's come into news media coverage a little bit. So I see those two main themes in news media coverage at Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Well, I grew up in the Davidian sect or little minor group within the Adventist Church, or without, since the Adventist Church, of course, distances itself from the Davidian movement, which is still springs from within it. And it just seemed to me that if somebody had told me 15 years ago, or even 5 years ago, that Ben Carson would ever be running for president, I would have laughed at them and have said, you know, that's crazy, because that's just not something that Adventists do or are taught to do, is run for public office or really engage in politics. So I always figured, you know, with Ben Carson, you know, it's kind of fame going to his head or something like that, because it's a very un-Adventist action, I think, that he's engaged in right now, you know, even though he spent his life as kind of like Mr. Adventist. Would you say that's a, you know, that's...
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists don't tend to be terribly political, and when they are political, they're evenly matched between the left and the right. But when I came to California in 1977 to Pacific Union College in the Napa Valley, I met a woman who was a Seventh-day Adventist woman who was repeatedly running for Congress. So it's not that unusual. I think the Australian version of Seventh-day Adventism that I grew up with in my first 11 years was much more traditional and therefore insulated from the world. But in California, I encountered a more liberal form of Adventism that participated a little more with wider societies. So it's not, it's certainly not outside of my life experience to know of a Seventh-day Adventist running for political office, because, you know, I encountered that in my childhood when I was at Pacific Union College.
It's not unheard of, but it is uncommon, and for someone like Ben Carson specifically, you know, I'd say. But I'm just, you know, something we talk a lot about is immigration and other aspects of that. A lot of people say the Catholic Church is a universalist church, I think, and people don't often, you know, look at it a certain way, but it seems to me that the Adventist Church is one of the larger churches in the world right now that is fostering and intermingling of immigrants in a lot of different countries. Because if you look at a lot of European countries, for example, you'll see that the Adventist population or the Adventist churches in those countries, in those European countries, are all filled with immigrants, and there are no actual natives of those countries.
Well, I'll tell you a story. I noticed I was driving by a Seventh-day Adventist church, and there was the sign said, actually, Hispanic Seventh-day Adventist church. So I think what happened is there were a lot of missionaries in places like Latin America and Africa. So it is, there are large, like, immigrant populations within the church.
Well, that's...
There's
a trend of... Seventh-day Adventist church works sociologically very much like an escalator. It takes... Usually is attractive to people at the very bottom of... near the bottom of the socioeconomic spectrum. So it brings them in, it helps them to lead a more disciplined life, it gives them a better than average education, and then their children get a better than average education, will go on to often to a secular college, university, and then as they become more educated in the secular world, they will start to drift out of Seventh-day Adventism, so that then the, you know, the third generation tends to leave Adventism completely. So, you know, my father got two PhDs at secular universities at Michigan State and Manchester University in England. And then, you know, me, the son, you know, I left the Seventh-day Adventist Church when I was 18. So that's very typical among many of the Seventh-day Adventists I grew up with. Their grandparents have joined the church. Their parents have gotten a lot of secular education. And now our generation was moving on out of the church. So it tends in, certainly in the United States, England, and in the Western world, it's very much kind of like a three-generation phenomenon where the first generation comes in at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale. The second generation is doing better socioeconomically because they get more education. But then with the increase in secular education, then they start drifting out of the church, and usually the third generation then moves right on out of the church.
Luke, how long has your family been in this? And before the Seventh-day Adventists, what Protestant denomination was your family traditionally?
My family traditionally was C of E, Church of England, Anglican, which is very mainstream. And my parents both converted to Adventism in their teens.
And just what I've noticed, like I said, there are very few denominations, especially that go as unnoticed, Seventh-day Adventism, that are as strong in this world today as Seventh-day Adventism. And again, they are a kind of apolitical church, but I just find it, their whole cultural and religious impact is, I think, very large, but yet very, very hidden in some ways, or ignored in any case. And Ben Carson is like a very rare phenomenon when it achieves mainstream attention at all.
Well, Seventh-day Adventists are usually towards the bottom of the socioeconomic scale, so they're not going to make a big cultural or economic or political impact on the world. If every Seventh-day Adventist in the world disappeared tomorrow, the world would notice very little change. But you could also say that about Jehovah's Witnesses. If every Jehovah's Witness disappeared tomorrow, the world wouldn't notice much of a change. Or if every Gypsy disappeared tomorrow, the world would not notice much of a change. So when Seventh-day Adventists get that more secular education so that they can make more of an impact on the world, they then tend to leave the church. So it's very much an escalator and a three-generation phenomenon.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is they do have the universities, Andrews and so on, and the medical work, the hospitals and so on, and they have one of the, they have one of the largest missionary outreach programs in the world. And what I'm basically saying is that despite all this, comparative to other denominations, a lot of the impact of what they do in the world goes unnoticed. Jehovah's Witness, everybody knows Jehovah's Witnesses. It just seems to me that Adventists are less noticed, or people pay less attention to their
efforts. It's a very quiet form of living. You don't create a ruckus when you're a Seventh-day Adventist. It's an understated, quiet way of life. And, as opposed to, like, Mormonism is kind of like the counterpoint to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because they both developed at the same time. But Mormonism has much more of an emphasis on succeeding in this world. So Mormons make much more of an impact on this world. So the book of Seventh-day Adventist Pulitzer Nobel Prize winners is very, very short. You very rarely find the top of any profession or the top of any academic specialty where you find a Seventh-day Adventist. That's very rare. It is not a system that tends to produce that extreme level of excellence that one might associate, say, with Ashkenazi Jews or with mainstream Protestants. So it does produce a level of holiness. If you set foot in a Seventh-day Adventist home, or in a Seventh-day Adventist church, or in a Seventh-day Adventist school, or a Seventh-day Adventist college, there is a very distinct feel to it, just like if you set foot in certain forms of yoga. You will feel something immediately. And when you step foot on Seventh-day Adventist college campus, you will immediately kind of notice an otherworldly quality about it.
As far as their doctrine on salvation, maybe I'm getting them confused with Jehovah's Witness, but is there a belief that only a small handful of humanity will be saved in the long run?
That's one strand of belief. That's the traditional Seventh-day Adventist belief that only 144,000 people will be saved.
So what is the mainstream doctrine on salvation for the church?
That everyone who believes in Jesus Christ will be saved.
So I guess that excludes you now.
I guess.
Well, on that note, Luke, you've mentioned the air of holiness about, you know, Adventist facilities. How do you find that compares in your experience to the air of reverence or whatever you might term it in Orthodox synagogues?
They're on the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. Like, reverence is definitely a word you would use for a Seventh-day Adventist church or pretty much any Christian church that I've been in. Reverence is not a word that you would use for a synagogue. Synagogues are much more of a meeting place, and there's a much more of a kind of a social occasion, and Jews, you know, are very rarely reverent. Like Judaism and Seventh-day Adventism in that respect are kind of opposites, which is, you know, Seventh-day Adventists focus on the next life, on heavenly salvation, on your personal relationship with God. And those themes get comparatively little attention in Judaism, where the focus is on the community and the welfare of the community in this world. So Judaism produces Jews who are very passionate about this world. Seventh-day Adventists kind of it's almost like a form of narcotic that numbs people to a large degree to an urgent desire for action in this world while keeping the focus on the next world. So from a Seventh-day Adventist perspective, the next world is much more important than this world, while, you know, 99 Jews out of 100 would say that this world is more important than the next world.
There is going back kind of like, because in two respects, there's another respect in which Adventism and Orthodox Judaism are on different ends of the spectrum, and that's on diet. Adventism advocates a vegan or vegetarian diet, and Orthodox Judaism is, of course, kosher. They are similar in the fact that they're both big on buying kosher products in general, but, you know, Adventism, of course, forbids the eating of meat for the most part. There are certain parts of the church, of course, that tolerate it, the more liberal portions of the church. In any case, how do you feel, you know, there have been mixed studies, how do you feel the impact of vegetarianism is on these individuals to whom the Adventist church most appeals? In other words, those people you talk about on the lower end of the socioeconomic status, they are, you know, they can be impacted by the diet. Your mentality is obviously impacted by your diet. It's always seemed to me that a diet, you know, that vegetarianism has resulted in a slight decrease in the IQs of a lot of the individuals in the church. That's my personal assessment. What do you think of that?
Let me make one comment really quick. I'll let Luke respond. I'll make one observation. I mean, I've actually been a vegetarian for a while, and I did notice a decrease in overall energy. But one group that does also practices vegetarianism is called the Brahmin caste of Hinduism, and they're sort of seen as a very much as the elite group in India, and they practice vegetarianism. So I don't know about IQ, but I think it could reduce your energy overall.
Let me clarify that question, because vegetarianism properly practiced, I do believe, does not have any deleterious effects. But if improperly practiced, it can, I think, have some negative effects, and is sometimes improperly practiced within the church, you know, so, which leads to this problem in general. I'd just like to get your opinion on that, Luke.
Well, I think that the tendency of the church is towards the feminine. It makes the men more feminine, makes the women more feminine. The tendency of the church is towards, you know, creating people leading quiet, unobtrusive lives dedicated to helping others and to healing. So I think perhaps the huge soy content of the Seventh-day Adventist vegetarian diet may contribute to those higher estrogen levels. I've read articles saying that soy tends to create estrogen. So you know, the discouragement of competition, you know, the lack of emphasis on this worldly success. So I think the whole ethos of the church is towards towards the feminine. And so the church is a very feminine institution, and it kind of feminizes the men in the church as well as the women. And the vegetarian diet, I think, fits in with that ethos.
So how is, again, you know, kind of the change for, how did you find the change from, well, I guess, you know, to the kosher lifestyle? I know you did not change directly from Adventism to Orthodox Judaism, but in general, how did you find the change to the kosher lifestyle from, you know, a regular out secular lifestyle to that kosher lifestyle of Orthodox Judaism, health-wise or otherwise?
It was a shock. I mean, it was a challenge to adjust to Jewish food. I've remained a vegetarian. I'm a lifelong vegetarian. So, you know, I wasn't used to many forms of Jewish food. And, of course, anything with fish or meat in it, I wouldn't touch. So that was a shock. As far as manners goes, Seventh-day Adventists and Jews are kind of on the opposite side of the spectrum. Seventh-day Adventists, at least the ones I knew, tend to be very polite, courteous, you know, considerate, healing type people, while Jews tend to be very aggressive, particularly verbally aggressive, even verbally violent. Jews are very much focused on this life, so they're very passionate about, you know, getting things done, you know, in the here and now. So for all their superficial similarities, Seventh-day Adventists and Jews, you know, I experience them as, you know, complete opposite on the spectrum. Jews tend to speak very frankly about sex, money, power, fame, and the pursuit thereof. Seventh-day Adventists, like other Anglos, tend to be very circumspect in speaking about sex, money, power, fame. The natural passions, Judaism and Jews tend to have much more of a easygoing relationship with, while there's much more of a kind of a stiff upper lip attitude in the Anglo world that I grew up in. So it was an enormous culture shock as well as a culinary shock. It was just very, very different.
One thing you mentioned is the Seventh-day Adventist Church feminizes both men and women. How would you portray gender roles in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and how would you contrast that with gender roles between men and women in Orthodox Judaism?
Well, in traditional Adventism, there are traditional gender roles, just as in I assume, traditional forms of almost all religions. But in mainstream Adventism and liberal Adventism, you know, they're heavily influenced by the mores around us. So modern Orthodox Jews tend to be much more influenced by the secular mores than traditional Orthodox Jews. But there's much more of an explicit differentiation in sex roles in Orthodox Judaism than in Seventh-day Adventism. You know, there are many more laws in Orthodox Judaism, and there's much less mingling of the sexes in Orthodox Judaism than in Seventh-day Adventist. You know, it's not normal or natural to be, you know, hugging or shaking hands with members of the opposite sex in Orthodox Judaism. Seventh-day Adventism isn't that extreme. Clothing that Seventh-day Adventists would regard as modest would be regarded as immodest by Orthodox Jews. So Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Judaism is just a whole new level of restrictions, of laws, of traditions, of separations between Jew and Gentile, between male and female. So Orthodox Judaism is, you know, much more hardcore and challenging than Seventh-day Adventism, which is much more accessible to someone with a low IQ. You know, it'd be very, very difficult to get through a conversion to Orthodox Judaism with an IQ below 115.
Thing I've noticed about Orthodox temples or synagogues is they tend to be very plain. while some Reformed synagogues are more, some of the older ones even resemble like Christian cathedrals.
Yeah, Orthodox synagogues particularly tend to be very plain, but Seventh-day Adventist churches also tend to be plain. But in that competition, Orthodox synagogues are far more plain than Seventh-day Adventist churches.
For the most part, I find Adventism and Adventist people very charming. You know, not that I go to church anymore, but I do just find the whole part charming. But one thing that's interested me for a while is the role of bacteria in people and people throughout history and its role in influencing the mind and influencing certain events by controlling the bodies of people. And I believe today, and you know, you may or may not, I don't know what your familiarity with the role of the Candida virus or bacteria in many vegetarians is, Luke, but it seems it's quite common.
Wait, hold, Paul, are you talking about dangerous bacteria or healthy bacteria, like as in yogurt?
Well, the Candida virus, or the Candida, not virus, fungus is a, it originates in the stomach and is often fed by the starches and carbohydrates usually consumed by vegetarians, and you know, often causes a lot of difficulties for both a person's body and brain. And I just find interesting, you know, Luke talks about how low-key Adventists are, and it's I'm just you know, have you ever encountered the virus or the fungus rather, or do you think it's had a large impact on the way that most church members are?
I've read about Candida. I'm no expert on it. I think the way the Seventh-day Adventists are is produced by a whole ethos of the church, and that includes the diet, but it's just one facet of the whole ethos that produces the Seventh-day Adventist way of life, which from my experience is almost the opposite of the Jewish way of life. So, you know, when I go from a Jewish shtetl to Loma Linda University and back, it's a real mind altering experience, because they're just so very different.
Luke, does the kosher diet have any values to health, or do you see it more as to keep separatism between Jews and Gentiles?
It may have value for health. It certainly is useful for keeping a separation between Jews and Gentiles. Yeah.
Are you still vegetarian?
Yeah, I've been vegetarian all my life.
So you've never touched 1 ounce of meat ever?
Correct.
And so let's talk about your experience with the Alexander method, Luke. And, you know, it's I'm sure, Robert, you have discussed this before, but in terms of having grown up in the church, do you think that in any way led you to the Alexander movement in the world or in the secular world? Or was there, I mean, you know, there's a whole physical science, or, you know, health and healing and sanitariums and the whole background of programs from Dr. Kellogg to, well, Ben Carson today, you know, that the Adventist Church is famous for. So how did you, was that some part of your discovering the Alexander method later on?
No, I don't believe there was any connection. I never heard of the Alexander technique when I was in Adventism. The Alexander technique is more something that appeals to people in performance, such as professional actors and professional musicians, professional speakers, and professional athletes. And Seventh-day Adventists are rarely to be found among those groups, while Jews are very often to be found among those groups. So I would estimate that about a third of all Seventh-day Adventists, of all Alexander Technique teachers in the world are Jewish. But I'm not aware of any Alexander Technique teachers being Seventh-day Adventists. They might be, but I'm just not aware of it, never heard of it. So I think the Alexander Technique is very copacetic with to a Jewish mind and to the Jewish way of looking at life. And any connection between Seventh-day Adventism and the Alexander Technique, I'm just unaware of it.
Well, yeah, I was just wondering if anything within your raising in the church led you to, you know, an interest in the Alexander Technique.
Not that I'm aware, except to the degree that I was frustrated by certain things in my upbringing and never really had a guidance to how to get out of the problem. I had voice trouble, had trouble projecting my voice. I had a very clumsy style of running and even walking. And it was not graceful. So I was kind of a clumsy kid. But nobody ever talked to me about the Alexander Technique.
Yeah. And, you know, I find, you know, like I said, the whole area of interest with Adventism, with a lot of the newer denominations that might be considered fundamentalist, is that they are predominantly now in certain ways becoming increasingly not necessarily anti-Western, but no longer Western. And perhaps, you know, a church has to go or where the life is. And in terms of ethnic life, what I've seen observed over the past 20 years is the white Adventist churches in particular dying off, and especially in what Robert termed flyover country in our interview the other day, and being replaced by Hispanic speaking churches.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That is part of the escalator phenomenon that I mentioned earlier. Adventism, it tends to attract people at the bottom of the socioeconomic spectrum, lifts them up for a generation or two, and then as people get a secular education, they move on out. So Seventh-day Adventism is much more accessible to blacks and Hispanics than many other forms of religion. And so, yeah, one would expect that third world peoples and blacks and Hispanics would continue to exert more and more influence and control and membership in the church. And also from a Seventh-day Adventist perspective, the United States government is the enemy. It's, you know, suspected of teaming up with the Roman Catholic Church to institute Sunday laws to first force everybody to worship on Sunday. And the Seventh-day Adventists is this like negative reaction to the United States of America, while the Mormon Church is like a much more positive reaction to the United States of America. And so Mormons have flourished as a white dominant group in America and in American business and politics, while Seventh-day Adventists have remained very much on the margins.
Luke, have you seen sort of the downward escalator trend in a sense within Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, where individuals who are the least successful leave the religion?
Well, that's historically been true because Orthodox Judaism in particular has been a very difficult way of life, both demanding economically, it's an expensive way of life, and demanding in the rituals to be performed and the knowledge. So for centuries, you know, the least intelligent, least successful Jews would frequently become Christians. And so perhaps that's one reason why Ashkenazi Jews have an average IQ of around 115, and white non-Jews have an average IQ around 100, because, you know, our least intelligent would often take the easy way out and just become Christians.
Have you had any friends within the religion who were struggling economically and that has made it difficult and they've considered leaving?
I've known Jews who were considering leaving being Jewish, and these were pretty much primarily struggling Jews who weren't, you know, really making it in the world. So, you know, that does come up. It's no fun being the biggest loser at your synagogue. So if you're the biggest loser at your synagogue, you know, you may look for a way out of your pain.
I guess with Mormonism, what's fascinating is they put a strong emphasis on success like Judaism, but at the same time, they proselytize and among the poor, like they go to places like Polynesia to get converts. So you see kind of both elements within the Mormon church.
Right. And I think the proselytizing that they do is more to build up the Mormonism within the white American Mormon believer. So it's, you know, by going out and seeking converts, it helps to develop their own faith. But, you know, Mormonism historically has been a religion of white people.
Luke, how influential was your father, Desmond Ford, within the church?
He was a rock star in the church. He was one of the 10 most important Seventh-day Adventists of the last half of the 20th century. And he ended up leaving the church in 1980 in a doctrinal dispute, and thousands of people left with him, including hundreds of ministers that he trained over the years. So he was the creator of a great schism in the church in 1980 that continues to reverberate to this day.
And Paul, you told me that also your grandfather was fairly influential in the church as well.
Not within the church. It was within, like I said, in the 1930s, there was a similar schism in which Davidianism, or the Shepherd's Rod movement, originated in the Adventist church, because at the time, as Luke mentioned, originally in the Seventh-day Adventist church, they believed that the second coming would occur as soon as there were 144,000 members within the Adventist church. And this goes, I don't know if Luke is familiar. Are you aware of that doctrine?
Yes.
As well. Yeah. So, when that, you know, failed to, happen, you know, there were various schisms and, basically, a new doctrine came about the 144,000. And, yes, my grandfather was one of the originators of that and of the Shepherd's Rod message that came along and, what they call the message. And, that was the foundation that would later produce the Branch Davidians, you know, and the whole Waco deal that happened a few years, well, 20 years ago now, close to 20 years ago. But what I just find interesting is that when we look back on, you know, the whole controversy with Desmond Ford's issue, you know, it's not very well remembered now. I mean, too much, is it? Is it, Luke? Would you say that, or
I mean,
average? Sorry, go ahead.
I haven't spent much time in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the last 35 years.
Well, I mean, to your average Adventist, probably doesn't know anything about it, is what I'm saying.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's like that you have these whole huge controversies that arose in the 1930s and the 60s, and, you know, in your father's time, and today they're largely forgotten. In Orthodox Judaism, is it a more even course, or do controversies of a similar nature arise insofar as doctrine goes, or is it a more even?
There are very rarely controversies over doctrine in Orthodox Judaism or in any form of Judaism, so it's much more even. You know, Orthodox Judaism is something that goes very much from generation to generation to generation. There are disputes about how to observe Jewish law, and so Jews are as adept at feuding as Seventh-day Adventists, but they don't flame out over questions of doctrine. And perhaps the best introduction to what we're talking about is a movie called The Nostradamus Kid, which is just a wonderful movie about an Australian boy who raised a Seventh-day Adventist in Australia in the 1950s, and how he fears the world's coming to an end, and how he wants to sleep with the pastor's daughter before the world comes to an end. It also mentions the Shepherd's Rod movement, you know, which presaged the Branch Davidians. So it's currently available on YouTube. You can find the Nostradamus Kid. And then the other good, fun Seventh-day Adventist movie is The Road to Wellville, which is a very entertaining look at Dr. Kellogg and in Michigan and his health sanitarium around the turn of the century.
One thing that Seventh-day Dr. Kellogg has in common with Judaism is Dr. Kellogg was a promoter of a circumcision.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I think there are certainly trends in the Seventh-day Adventist Church that say that circumcision is a good and healthy thing. I was circumcised, but my brother was not. When my mother was dying of cancer, all of us kids were farmed out to various people to look after. And the people who took in my brother when he was like age 10 or 11 just decided without even consulting my parents to go have him circumcised.
But the thing about Judaism is with Judaism, they believe that circumcision is a commandment by God. Dr. Kellogg was actually pretty honest that he believed that in reducing sexual pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's certainly also a teaching in Orthodox Judaism that circumcision reduces sexual pleasure. But it's not an explicit commandment in Seventh-day Adventism to circumcise your boys. Oh, Paul, have you seen the Nostradamus Kid?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Luke?
Have you seen the movie The Nostradamus Kid?
I have not, no. I'll have to take a look at that on YouTube.
Yeah, because it mentions the Shepherd's Rod. It's hilarious.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up in many ways. I think I've heard of the movies, and I would, in many ways, I'd probably agree with you there. In terms of all, in your perspective in having been through two religions, or having been through one and now are actively engaged in another one, we live in an age in which secular self-help is prominent, and religion as a form of self-help is frowned upon, if not scorned. Do you believe, or what do you think is the best way? Do you think religion trumps, or can trump, the secular forms of self-help that do not involve, you know, any sort of worship of God or
It depends.
Tradition.
It depends on the individual and the problem. There are some problems that are best answered by religion, and different religions answer different problems. So if your primary concern is, you know, will I spend eternity in heaven, you're going to want to look to Christianity, because that's the focus of Christianity. The focus of Judaism is on making a difference in this world. The focus of Islam is, I think, more on conquering this world. So I don't have at my fingertip the primary focus of Hinduism and Buddhism. I think Buddhism is inner peace. But, you know, whatever the end you want, there's often a religion that's best suited for that end. But then many questions are not, generally speaking, best answered by religion. For instance, if you've got an addiction to drugs or alcohol or to pornography or to spending, I think if you've got an addiction operating in your life, that for most people they'll be better served going to a 12-step program than simply joining a religion. For other problems, they'd be best served by psychotherapy. So, you know, if you want to know about what happened historically in Egypt 3,200 years ago, you would not be best served by consulting a religion, but by consulting those who make, you know, ancient Egyptian history their specialty. And, you know, if your primary concern is on macroeconomic policy and how to balance full employment with low inflation, then you'd be both best served by consulting macroeconomic theory and not religion. So, you know, religion can answer or deal with certain questions in a way that's effective for many people, but for many other problems and questions, the better and more effective answers lie outside of religion.
I mean, Luke, you've had narcissistic personality disorder. How has your symptoms correlated with what religion you were in?
Yeah, religion's made no difference to my narcissistic personality disorder. Like it made some difference in some of my other addictions, like temporarily. Like as long as I was God intoxicated and, you know, totally devoted to my religion, it would keep my other destructive impulses kind of at bay. But as that enthusiasm waned, as it inevitably does for most people, then my addictions came roaring back, and I had to deal with them through psychotherapy and through 12-step work. For other people, you know, they'd be best served by yoga or by the Alexander technique or, you know, other modalities.
On your Facebook posts, you've developed a you have a very very witty Facebook posting style that seems to just increase. It can keep me in stitches often. Do you attribute this to you know, the Jewish culture in which you're immersed, or the Orthodox Judaic culture which you're exposed to?
I think probably more has more to do with family dynamics. We all grow up to play a certain role. So for me, I tend to be very uncomfortable with tension when people are tense and ill at ease around me. So I've always been the one to make jokes. So, you know, since I was a kid, I was always the one to make jokes. And then, you know, other people I know have learn from their early upbringing to take charge. That's how they try to run everybody's life. That's how they deal with tension. Other people try to make themselves invisible. Other people, you know, they try to be the good son or the good daughter and uphold the family's values. You know, other people are the rebel, and that's the role that they developed early on in their life. So it's kind of uncanny how we all develop a role to deal with our family dynamics, you know, usually in the first 6, 7, 8 years of life. And then we stay on that role, you know, without questioning. We don't even, you know, question our role for the rest of our life. And that's where psychotherapy and 12-step and perhaps other modalities can help you notice how you developed a particular coping mechanism with your, you know, your early childhood to deal with the particular dynamics of your family. And then that becomes an addiction, and you just, you know, keep unthinkingly always going back to those same responses to stimuli, such as, you know, either making people laugh or, you know, being the good child who upholds the family values, or trying to run everybody's life, or just being invisible so that people won't hurt you. And so I think all of those roles tend to become unthinking, unseen addictions for most of us.
There's also a rich tradition of a Jewish tradition of self-deprecating humor, which kind of ties in with what you're saying. You know, it's, on one side, a person can make jokes about themselves and seemingly cast themselves as the unfortunate one within their humor, and at the same time have it, you know, have an enormous ego and enormous, you know, it's just their way of trying to blend in or trying to associate themselves with their audience. You know,
but I did find in Judaism was much more of a permission to be, you know, who I am. There's a much broader range of you know, speech and you know, way of articulating what you're thinking and what's going on that's acceptable in even Orthodox Judaism than in Seventh-day Adventist, where you're much more expected to behave like someone who's always saved. And if you don't behave in a very cookie-cutter way, then you know, your relationship with God is in peril and you need a closer walk with God. So Jews and Judaism are much more accepting of a more raw and a, you know, a more honest and more emotional approach. And so there's much more freedom, I find, to, you know, to say everything I want to say and to express myself among Jews and in Judaism than I found in Seventh-day Adventism, which I found stifling.
I guess, Paul Bingham, you wanted to bring up Max Hardcore, the infamous pornographer. And I gotta say, I mean, Max Hardcore is probably symbolic of, like, the absolute polar opposite of everything the Seventh-day Adventist Church or Christianity stands for.
Well, I would hope that the same would be true of Orthodox Judaism,
so Robert. So, Luke, you've interviewed Max, and what was your take on him as a person?
Yeah, I've not just interviewed Max. I've been around Max for hours and hours and hours. You know, I know Max Hardcore really well. Tends to be very charming. Tends to be, you know, he's quite intelligent, thoughtful person, and he's just got this, you know, this dark side that he lets out on camera. And when he's drunk, he's very tightly wound. So you never quite know when he'll explode. But, you know, he's also a guy who doesn't mind stepping into a church to meditate at times. So I generally found him very articulate, intelligent, and charming. But he was also kind of scary, dangerous. You could just kind of sense the violence, you know, just very close to the surface.
Would you say his pornography is very much motivated by either sadism or a strong sense of or anger, eroticized rage?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, all pretty much all pornography is, you know, you're fooling yourself if you don't think it is. He just takes pornography to its logical conclusions. So he was brilliant at what he did.
Do you think that? What do you think Max Hardcore's impact on the industry has been?
Oh, it's been massive. You know, he's taken porn to his logical conclusions, and so he's you know, a very important figure in the history of pornography.
And ironically, Max Hardcore, the most controversial guy in porn, is actually a Gentile.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, in terms of his incarceration and the whole free speech issue that emerged from that, you know, certainly he will be remembered as one of the, you know, historical figures of the past decade in the pornographic industry.
Yeah, he's a very important figure, and he did his work very well.
Yeah, you know, obviously, I don't know where I was cut off from, but my question was, in terms of his overall impact, has Max Hardcore spawned imitators, and what is the porn industry's general opinion of him?
Well, he was very controversial in the industry. The industry generally had a negative view of him because he kind of presents their, you know, their worst side to the public. You know, he tended to be unpopular, but, you know, he was a pioneer, and he pushed boundaries and pushed limits, and pretty much everyone in any genre who pushes limits and boundaries and pioneers something is going to be hated.
Luke, how do you coincide your social conservative views with interviewing people like Max Hardcore?
It doesn't make any difference, like, what my opinions are. You know, I'd be happy to go to a prison and interview mass murderers. You know, I'd be happy to interview Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin or Saddam Hussein or, you know, the Night Stalker or pornographers. It makes no difference. I just want to learn something and get something important out of the interview.
Now, in terms of Max Hardcore, it appears to me, and I may be wrong about this, that the violent porn genre peaked several years ago and has been in decline. Is that your opinion, or do you think that, you know, violent porn is still predominant?
I haven't watched pornography in 8 years.
I haven't either. But I'm just asking as an overall trend within the shooting or filming of violent porn and the sales of violent porn. Do you think they're, you know?
I haven't kept up with it. I've been out of the industry for 8 years.
I haven't had no desire
to keep up with it. But there's an element of violence in all sexual intercourse, you know, whether it's pornographic or not. So there's always going to be a strong element of violence in all pornography.
Certainly true.
What do you see as some of the main motivations and interests in that men, the psychology of men who have interest in that genre of porn?
Well, I think life for most men is just, you know, endless sexual frustration. So this is one way of dealing with that endless sexual frustration. So men who almost all womanizers, and I would expect, you know, most hardcore pornography users have had a troubled relationship with their mothers, and so they didn't get, you know, that natural human connection that normal people get, and so this is kind of their substitute. You know, it's a way to deal with their rage.
Like I said, I just that'd be my final question. That Robert, anyone regarding Max Hardcore, that would be, you know, the last issue I really wanted to touch on with Luke. Well, let me put it this way: would you vote for Ben Carson, Luke?
Sure. I mean, I would much prefer Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, but between Hillary Clinton and Ben Carson, I'd vote for Ben Carson.
In terms of, and do you feel that Cruz and Trump's leadership abilities trump their, as it were, trump their naturally disingenuous tendencies, whereas Carson's relative naivety makes him unfit for leadership?
I mean, I'd be hard pressed to say that any Republican is a worse choice than Hillary Clinton. So, you know, I don't think it matters that Donald Trump, for instance, says he saw thousands of Muslims celebrating in New Jersey when it turns out maybe there are only dozens. You know, I don't think that's particularly important. There's nothing that Donald Trump has said that terribly bothers me. You know, as long as Donald Trump builds a wall and restricts illegal immigration and restricts legal immigration, he's good by me. And compared to the issue of immigration, nothing else really matters.
Do you think there's any prospect of a wall being built in the next decade?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump, if he's elected, will definitely build it, because that's, you know, he's built his whole campaign on it. And I think you'll see, you know, troops, you know, rush to the border as soon as he becomes president. And you can already tell, you know, Mexicans are panicking and you know, thinking about maybe they'll need to go back to Mexico. They're already kind of making plans for what will happen if Donald Trump is elected president. So I kind of like seeing him putting the panic in Hispanic.
One thing I saw on Facebook, I sent you this meme. It's this picture of a bunch of young naked women in a boat. And it's like, so it says something like the kind of immigration policy we should have.
Yeah, I'm fine with all, you know, hot white chicks who want to move here. As long as they're of, you know, average or above average IQ, I'm all for that, even if they arrive here illegally on boats. I just don't want any more non-whites coming here, and I'd really want to encourage most of our non-white citizens to leave, unless, you know, they're particularly productive and important. You know, I think we can do quite well without them. I want a dominantly white ethno state, so I'm happy with the historic percentage where the, you know, the white percentage historically has been between 80% and 90%. So, you know, America like it was prior to the 1965 Immigration Act, that's what I would like. And you know, we're importing all these, you know, really ugly little people from Mexico and Central America, and that's crazy to me. Now, if you're going to have immigrants, let them be hot Swedes.
Would you make an exception for Syrian refugees if they were young, hot women?
No, I don't want any Muslims. You know, I just don't want any Syrians. I mean, their average IQ is, you know, 81. You know, we can do without them.
My whole argument against immigration is traffic.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that day. There was that day in LA, a day without a Mexican, and there was like no traffic on the 405.
Yeah, I mean, how wonderful would that be? Like, just imagine, you know, getting up in the morning and there are no Mexicans in California. I mean, it would just be heaven. The streets wouldn't be, you know, full. There'd be a significant reduction in crime. There'd be much more social capital and trust between people. People would be more pleasant to look at. I mean, the aesthetic consideration is a huge one. You know, white people are really good looking compared to other races.
I don't see anything particularly wrong with that. I don't believe Donald Trump is either capable or particularly interested in doing anything that he says he's going to do. But I was a, Pat Buchanan supporter quite early on. So, you know, I've been very active in politics and political campaigns. So, you know, I just have less faith in political candidates than, you know, other individuals, you know, who have not gone through the ringer, as it were, in terms of political campaigning.
Well, Donald Trump is the first populist who might become president in, you know, well over 100 years. We've never had a populist make a serious run for president of the United States. And that's a fascinating thing. He's a populist and he's a nationalist. He believes in the power of genetics. You know, I get the sense that he's believes in HBD, human biodiversity. And I think he, you know, he just might be a warrior for white people.
Yeah, I mean, we've had people like Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan, but they didn't get they didn't have the same chance for the presidency.
Yeah, they weren't as populist as Donald Trump.
Well, we will certainly see what emerges. But Luke, do your views? I mean, you hold what a lot of people would consider to be controversial views. How does this, in other words, does this in any way interfere with your lifestyle? It's very difficult for some people to, you know, be openly holding the views that you do and, you know, not suffering negative consequences from society.
Not yet. So I've been, you know, out of the closet about these things for years. And I'm assuming I give off a vibe that I can't be bullied, because when people try to bully me, I fight back very firmly. And so it's been a long time since anyone's tried to bully me, so I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I think they tend to bully on people who are a little softer and who are more interested in fitting in with polite society. And, you know, it's very important to them that they maintain a place in polite society. But for people like myself, or for Steve Saylor, or Chateau Artiste, or some of these, you know, Greg Johnson, Jared Taylor, now, we've made our choices and we're out there, and we can't be intimidated and we can't be bullied. And I think once you make the decision that, you know, you're fine with giving up your place in polite society, you're giving up all chances of honor, then, you know, you're like a soldier who goes into battle and considers, you know, look, I'm already dead.
Yeah,
so it helps that you're self-employed. And you've always been a nonconformist. But if you're dependent on other people for your livelihood, then you have to kind of toe the line.
Exactly.
And you know, to a certain extent, how far do you believe, you know, in terms of support for the Trump campaign, are you actively campaigning for Trump, or are you?
No. I just sit back and write what I think or share what I see. I mean, he may prove to be a total fraud and a charlatan, and I'll write that when the time comes, when I see that. So I'm not someone who engages in the political process. I'm someone who just kind of looks at it and comments about it. I'm not an activist. I'm not going to be trying door to door.
A journalist.
Yeah.
I engaged in political activism to learn how it was done. And, I did not really have any, aspirations for my candidate's success. I never had any illusions about that, but I did gain a pretty thorough working understanding of the workings and mechanics of the political process, which enabled me to better now prognosticate about it. But in any case, last question, Luke, next to last question, you mentioned Chateau Hartiste. You have a unique perspective on many things from your, from your experience in, studying, very diverse, interests from pornography to Orthodox Judaism. What do you think of Chateau Hartiste as a overall, I don't know how long you followed it, but, I've followed it, whatever it is, whoever it is. Since its inception, the blog, what do you think of it? Is it a work of art? Is it just a political blog? What do you make of the whole structure?
Well, I think he's a giant. He's an absolute giant, but that doesn't mean he's good for everybody. I'm sure there are many people better off not reading his website. I may make the decision, tomorrow for some reason that, I had to disengage from the website. Now, it's not for everyone, but he's a giant. He's brilliant. And for many people, they will gain a great deal of wisdom. And, they'll swallow the red pill of reality if they read the Chateau. But for, other people, it may not be good for their peace of mind, their equilibrium, and for their sobriety. And so... it's like religion or yoga or Alexander Technique or whatever. It's not for everyone. For some people, the Chateau is poison. And for other people, it is, life-saving.
So we are out of time. I would like to thank our guest, Luke Ford, and also our co-host, Paul Bingham, for being on. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.